the bathroom, regretting it the moment I opened the bedroom door. There were more of them. Along the hallway, in the shower, dozens more out of the window, all almost exactly like me, apart from the varying severity of their injuries. Some were old, others children, men and women, all looking at me with my face and my eyes. Some were completely intact, while others were maimed and shredded, until they were little more than piles of shattered bones and oozing gore. All staring at me, turning their heads as I moved, silently judging me for every mistake I'd ever made to reduce them to this pitiful state. "One more thing." The moth followed me as I returned to the bedroom. "When you do kill the ones you don't want, please be quick about it. Sometimes they don't like to go quietly." My eyes immediately darted to the knife on the floor. It was gone. I automatically pressed my back to the wall, my new heart lurching in my chest. My eyes scanned the room. Something was different. One of them wasn't here. "Of course, there's always the chance one of them will get the better of you," the moth drawled on, not showing the least concern. "Then you'll be the part that was left behind." I took a hesitant step farther into the room. The door slammed shut behind me. A blur of movement, I barely darted out of the way in time. That deformed stroke face, Love. She'd been hiding behind the door when I entered. Now she was lunging again, the knife lighting up the air between us.
"Stop wasting time,"
creature slurred, spit flying from its uneven mouth.
"We both know it's me you want."
I fell straight on my ass, trying to get out of the way. I turned and began scampering on my hands and knees, flinging myself across the floor to escape from its lurching advance.
"You think it's my fault?"
she wailed. Each word felt heavy and deliberate. A mentally deficient person struggling to be understood and growing more frustrated by the second.
"I didn't do this to you."
I regained my feet and faced my adversary. The knife fell again, but I managed to catch her by the wrist. She roared with unintelligible fury as I wrestled the knife from her hand. I almost plunged it into her without thinking. The tortured misery on her face, on my face, the rejection and loneliness. I hesitated just for a moment too long. Hands grappled me from behind, grabbing both my arms to hold me in place. Two more of the impassive copies, I couldn't tell which, wrestling me onto the bed. I didn't let go of my knife, but it didn't matter if I couldn't use it. The deformed Love was on top of me, her lips peeled back from her functional side to sink her teeth into my neck. I strained to pull away, but the other two had me firm. I screamed, though words failed me, yelping a noise like an animalistic snarl. One of the hands on my arm slackened just a bit at the sound. Did they feel sorry for me? I didn't have time to think. I lashed out with the knife, gouging a deep line across Love's face. She grunted, but didn't let up. Her teeth were digging deeper into me. I cut again and again, hacking and slashing at the loose folds of her uneven face. The grip behind me suddenly released. I pounced on my victim, hesitating no longer. Both hands on the handle, I impaled the creature in the chest with all my strength. The blade tore through her so easily, dancing through rotted and pitted skin, down her bloated body, ripping a line all the way from her sternum to her groin. One look at the bloody mess underneath me, and I knew I was done here.
"Bring me back," I shouted. "I've done what I had to do."
The world was spinning around me. I closed my eyes, trying my best to keep breathing without being nauseous. The flaccid bodies filling my house began to howl with one voice. One wall of noise at first, but as it went on, the different voices began to weave between each other, swelling and diminishing in an intricate melody, almost indistinguishable from mindless screaming. It was either the most beautiful or the most horrendous sound I've ever heard. Perhaps both. And then I was through. The howling abruptly stopped. My heart was throbbing. My breath came in ragged gasps. I was standing outside my bedroom door again.
Is someone there?
It was my wife. The sound of her voice was even more disgusting than the cacophony I'd endured.
Stop worrying. You said he'd be gone all day, right?
That deep voice, the one that didn't matter. Now that I thought about it, neither of them did. I turned and walked down the stairs as quietly as I could. I had a second chance, or perhaps a hundredth if I'd been through all this before. I wasn't going to waste it on her. She'd never know how much of myself she made me destroy, but it was better this way. My time on the other side has changed me, and looking down at the love I killed with my own hands, I knew I had transformed myself into someone who could survive this. When I had plunged my knife into that rotted belly, I had looked down on more than decay and ruin. I'd seen a child blossoming inside the fetid corpse of love, and if I was careful and kind to it, I knew it would grow to replace the one that I killed. Night 13. My daughter spoke before she was born.
Mummy?
My daughter's first word. Isn't that what every new mother is dying to hear? One word to magically transform this organic object into a new human being. All the pain and fear and doubt suddenly have purpose. One word, and mothers will know it was all worthwhile.
I love you, Mummy.
I just wish little Claire had waited until she was born to say it. Over 8 months pregnant, I was sitting in the car waiting for my husband to get back with the groceries. I almost had a heart attack on the spot. I thought someone was in the car with me, so I jumped out to get a better look in the back seat, but don't worry, Mummy, it'll be our little secret. The voice was coming from inside me. I felt the vibrations as much as I heard it with my ears, almost like the rumbling of indigestion. I didn't say a word when my husband got back. I was waiting for Claire to talk again, but when she didn't, I just kept my mouth shut too. My husband had more than enough to worry about with his extra shifts at work. I didn't want him to add my sanity to his worries.
I don't like that. It's nasty.
I put down the salad I was eating. Alone in the kitchen this time, Claire only spoke when I was alone. Usually, it was just an isolated word or something I'd catch her humming along to a song that was playing. If she didn't like something, she'd let me know. She didn't care for most vegetables, and jazz music seemed to make her restless. As weird as it seems, it's something I got used to. I grew into the habit of asking her how she was doing and if she was comfortable. I'd tell her about the things we'd do together, and I talked about myself. Sometimes, if I was lucky, I'd hear her respond, a faint murmur, so far away but so intimate that I knew it could be nothing else.
There are lots of colours, Claire answered once when I asked her what it looked like.
But they're all black. It's warm and close and safe. I'm part of everything here.
What about before you were there? I asked. What's the earliest thing you can remember?
I could feel her squirming. She didn't speak again for almost a day after that. Until suddenly, when I was about to enter the shower, she said,
I don't want to talk about it. Before isn't a nice place. The people living there aren't nice people.
I didn't want to upset her, so I didn't pry any further. Besides, even thinking about it made me uncomfortable, and I felt as though my discomfort would be passed on to Claire somehow. We were two halves of the same soul, and it almost seemed like I could feel her thinking before she even spoke.
Mummy,
she asked one night, when I lay half asleep in the solitary darkness. My husband was on a business trip, and it was just going to be me until a few days before I was due.
Who else is inside you?
I told her that she was an only child, that she was so big she took up my whole tummy all by herself, and that soon she was going to be too big even for that. Then she would come out where I am, and we could see each other for the first time.
Are the people nice out there? She asked.
I had to tell her the truth. If I didn't, I figured she could probably feel it. I told her that people try to be good, but some of them don't know how. But she shouldn't worry, because I'm going to teach her how. and then she can teach everyone she meets. I was almost in tears as I said it, marvelling at the wonder I carried. Claire and I will have known each other more truly than any mother and daughter before. Our bond would be stronger. I was so happy to have this blessing until... Don't lie to me, Mummy. I know I'm not the only one here. I told her not to be silly. I'd been to the doctors, and they showed me what it looked like inside. There wasn't anyone. One of them followed me, Claire interrupted. From the before place. Mummy, make them go away. I did my best to reassure her, but I was completely helpless against her mounting distress.
Don't let it hurt me. Don't let it take me back. I don't want to go back. I want to be with Mummy.
She wouldn't listen to anything I said. I couldn't get through to her anymore. Listening to her cry inside me was more than I could bear. But then she started shrieking, and I had to get out of the house. I hustled to the car as quickly as my swollen body would allow, made even more difficult now that Claire was thrashing and kicking inside. I was trying to stay strong for her, but I was so terrified as I ripped down the streets towards the hospital. I'm sure she must have felt that too. I was doing everything I could to stifle my sobs when the kicking suddenly stopped. There was no movement at all, no sounds, and I thought that was even worse than the crying, until she spoke again. I have to go away, Mummy. It was nice talking with you. I was at the hospital now. I practically drove straight through the glass doors in front of the emergency room.
Don't go, Claire. Don't go.
But I didn't say it out loud. Instead, I said,
Please help me. There's something wrong with my baby.
The nurse asked me how I knew, and I didn't know how to answer. I just started crying again. They put me in a wheelchair and brought me into an examination room. The nurse said she would be right back, but I didn't want to be left alone. At least while someone was here, I could tell myself that Claire wasn't speaking because of them. If she stayed quiet when I was alone, though... Don't cry, Mummy. I held my breath, desperate to catch every word. Claire was speaking so faintly that I could barely hear her over the frantic, double percussion of my heart.
You're not going to be alone. The one from the before place is here. He promises to be good, but I want you to be careful, Mummy. Goodbye.
The nurse was back, and there was a doctor with her. I think they were trying to ask me questions, but my whole awareness was so focused on any movement or sound from within that I couldn't register what they were saying. They started doing an ultrasound, although it took a long time before I stopped shaking enough for them to get a clear picture. The whole while, Claire didn't say a word. That was okay, though. She never did when people were around. Maybe when they were gone, she would. But then, the doctor gave me a big smile, and I let out gasps of stale air that I didn't even know that I was clinging to.
I want you to know that you have nothing to worry about, the doctor said. The baby is perfectly healthy.
I'm sorry, I told him. I don't know what I was thinking. I shouldn't have bothered you.
Don't worry about it, he said, taking off his gloves. It's common for expecting mothers to have anxiety or panic attacks, even hallucinations sometimes.
Hallucinations? Yeah, I managed. I guess it's a pretty traumatic time for the body.
Exactly, he said. But I want you to know that nothing in the world is wrong. Just a few weeks, and you're going to be holding your son for the first time.
My son?
Yes, Mum. Didn't you know? Look here. It even looks like he's smiling.
Night 14. Behind closed doors. Those of us who survive what happens behind closed doors don't talk about it much more than those who didn't. And you? You know there are mothers who look at their children as blood-sucking leeches, blaming them for their dwindling energy and passion for life. You know there are fathers who see their daughters as a possession, their innocence a vulnerability to exploit. You know that drugs or alcohol or the festering hatred of wasted years can curdle the blood until convictions of right and wrong subtly transform into, is someone watching or not? But we don't talk about it, because maybe it's our fault that they don't love us anymore. And you don't think about it, afraid your own love will be spoiled by the guilt of those who go without. But if I'm going to be brave enough to talk,
then I want you to be brave enough to listen. We are no longer children, and we must both accept that closing our eyes does not make the monsters go away anymore. My parents died in a car accident when I was 14. Uncle Viren and Aunt Isabel said that they had always wanted a daughter, and took me in after that, treating me with the polite indifference you'd use to summon your waiter. And that was okay with me, because I wasn't really expecting to have a family again. I had one once, and wanting that intimacy back with other people seemed disrespectful to their memory. Wherever I would go, whoever I would be with from that day on, I knew I would be alone. Viran was always watching me with his beady little eyes, nearly invisible behind huge spectacles. Isabel tolerated me, although she was better at it when I stayed in my room. And life went on. I never stopped wearing black after the funeral, but over time I added some bows and lace, because Uncle thought I looked depressing. It wasn't good enough for him, though. He bought me a lot of brightly coloured ornaments to wear, so the room didn't look like someone turned out the lights every time I entered. Isabel thought it was a waste of money, and I agreed. There was something powerful and elegant in my dark wardrobe which protected me from life's banalities. The other things made me feel like a clown on display, an object for the sole purpose of being seen and used. I'd try them on, though, whatever it was. Pink dresses, sun hats, stiletto shoes. Uncle would make me model them, striking poses and spinning around, while his eyes sparkled with undisguised appetite. I'd thank him politely, keeping the rest of my words to myself, waiting for his face to flush with sweat and his words to awkwardly tangle in his mouth before he'd let me leave.
They were nice things, he told me, expensive things. He wanted to keep them clean, so he made me undress to store them safely. Not in the bathroom where I could spill water on them. Not in my bedroom where I kept it so dirty. Right here in the living room. It's all right. There's no one else here, and I do what I was told, he'd remind me, because I was a good girl who appreciated everything he'd done for me.
Isabel was returning from the store when she caught him like that once. His hands were already on me, helping to slide my new skirt down. I caught her eye with a sort of helpless pleading. She got so angry she actually started trembling, her lips pressing into a bloodless scar. I thought that was going to be the end of this game. She was going to yell at her husband and swoop in to save me like my own mother would have done if she'd found me like that. But my mother wasn't here anymore. Isabel turned around and went into the kitchen without another word. Uncle followed her, and I took the chance to run for my bedroom. I listened against the door for a sound of a fight, but they were both speaking low and soft. All I could hear was the frenzied pounding of blood in my veins and the mounting scream of a tea kettle. I thought she was just making herself a cup to calm down until my door opened 5 minutes later. I knew something bad was going to happen as soon as I saw her. Face like plastic, thick rubber gloves up to her elbow, and tea kettle in hand.
Viren told me everything,
Isabel said as she sat down beside me on the bed. She touched me with one of those rubber gloves, and I started shaking so bad the headboard rattled.
I don't want to do this, but it's for your own good. Girls have empty heads sometimes and must be taught lessons that are not easily forgotten.
Isabel's carefully maintained countenance twisted into a snarl when she grabbed my hair and began to pour the boiling water over my head. The more I cried, the louder she yelled to be heard.
How dare I seduce her husband, she said. Selfish slut, just like my mother. Homewrecker, ungrateful bitch, two-faced whore.
By the time the kettle was empty, I was writhing in agony on my soaked bedsheets. I just lay there, gasping, my tears evaporating where they ran across my scalded skin. My eyes were too swollen to see, but I heard her stand and exit the room.
Even if you try, I don't think he'll want you now anyway, she said as she left.
When the door closed, I tried to pull my drenched shirt off, but every brush of fabric on skin was excruciating. I had to cut myself free with a pair of scissors, biting my tongue to keep myself from howling. Then, staggering to the bathroom to splash cool water on my face, I could see blisters the size of my nose already forming on my hands and neck, which had taken the worst of it. It took almost a week for the swelling to come down. Aunt Isabel bought me aloe lotions and cooed over me like it had been an unfortunate accident. Uncle didn't even look at me, so I guess I should have been grateful in a way. As my skin continued to heal, I kept applying rouge to make it look like the skin was still scalded. I thought maybe he'd leave me alone as long as he thought I was ruined, but I couldn't keep up the disguise forever. 1 week was all the respite I got. I felt his hands resting on my shoulders as I peered into the fridge, their gentleness as vile as Isabel's iron grip. He said, "I was sorry for what happened. It was wrong of her to treat me like a child. He knows I'm not a child anymore, or to punish me, when I had been so good. Not to worry," he assured me. "Next time, she'll never find out. Next time, he's going to have a special present to make up for what happened." He was right about one thing. I wasn't a child anymore. You can't stay a child after something like that has happened, no matter how hard you try. With his hands running down my back, as lightly as snow upon a grave, I knew what next time meant. There wasn't going to be a next time, though, because I was going to run away. Over dinner that night, I made a big show, coughing and playing sick. I told them I felt like I could sleep forever. Once in my room, I stuffed a couple of pillows under my blanket to make it look like someone was still sleeping there. But I wasn't taking any chances. I'd even picked up a cheap wig, which perfectly matched my auburn hair. After fastening it around a soccer ball, I pulled the blankets way up to its chin and took a step back to survey my work. I briefly considered trying to rig up one of the audio recorder setups where a string is attached to the door and plays a message when it's opened. But it seemed too complicated, and I was already terrified of being caught before I got out. Isabel hadn't entered my room since she burned me, and Uncle seemed uncomfortable there as well. I hoped they would just think I was sick and not disturb the dummy until I was a long way from here. My backpack was stuffed with clothes, some snacks, and about $40, and I looked back one last time before I left. As terrible as it was here, I had no delusions that life outside would be any easier. I figure people are going to suffer no matter where they are, but at least now I could choose how. I didn't think anything could make me stay longer in that house, but then again, I couldn't have expected what I saw when glancing back. The pillows I'd carefully lain under the covers had shifted. The bundle was leaning back against the headboard now, the long auburn hair falling down to completely obscure the soccer ball. Then, before my eyes, the dummy head moved, now to the left, now to the right, the wig swishing softly as it dragged along the sheets. Now it was looking right at me, or at least I think so. I still couldn't see anything under the thick hair. I took a step towards the window, then a step back into the room. The head followed me both times. Then the whole form began to stand upright, although the sheet hung loosely as though an emaciated human frame was hidden beneath, rather than the pillows I had placed there. Does that mean the soccer ball was gone too? As it lurched towards me, I could only imagine what horrifying visage was underneath the hair now. I stood frozen as it stopped in front of me. Up close, I saw the hair wasn't a wig anymore. It looked so soft and real that I had to stop myself from reaching out to touch it. For a gut-clenching moment, I thought it looked like my mother's hair. But no, it was so much longer and wilder than hers. But wasn't the figure about the same height as my mother, just a head taller than me? "Are you going to help me?" I asked. The hair nodded as the head bent from forward and back. A shift in the sheet let a cold wind escape outward, as though someone had opened a window. "Are you going to punish them?" It was definitely a nod this time. I was so relieved that I couldn't contain the rush of bubbling thoughts and my feelings swelling up within me. The idea that it was my mother made me want to laugh and cry at the same time. It was my mother. It had to be. She'd never stopped watching me, even from the other side. She saw what happened, and she wasn't going to forgive them. She was going to make them suffer because they deserved it. And she was going to save me because... A whisper. I couldn't hear what she said. I leaned closer, and she spoke again. "Switch places with me." "What do you mean?" A short, powerful rush of air entered the form, and she spoke louder, as though she was gradually waking up. "I'm not of your world, and cannot hurt them until I enter. Switch places with me,
Let me have my fun, and then I will trade back with you when I'm finished.
The voice was more real with every word. I could imagine myself back in our old house with Mother tucking me into bed at night. The security of her presence, the affection of her voice, the unbridled fury at anyone who would do me wrong. I devoured those words, that love, that anger. It's what kept me alive.
What's it like, your world? I asked. But even as I did, I knew it didn't matter.
Yes, I'll switch places. It won't take long to punish them, will it?
The head shook, a fleeting glance of a green eye shining beneath the hair, and then it was gone.
Cut your finger, she instructed me, and I did so without question, pinching the skin of my forefinger with the scissors beside my bed. These scissors, which I'd used to cut my scalding shirt off, would now be used for revenge. I'd never felt so sweet a pain in my life.
Now let your mother taste it.
The voice was deeper now, more masculine, but I didn't care. All I could think about was how good it would feel to see them pay. I'd be able to live alone here, taking care of myself. I wouldn't have to be quiet anymore, or afraid. Or maybe Mom could come back and visit when this awful business was over, and we could talk like we used to. My dad must be there too, and I could even switch with him to let him play a round of golf and enjoy the sun again. I lifted my cut finger up inside the wild hair and felt the cold wind licking the blood from me, and I smiled. My finger was ice, and it felt cool and refreshing on skin still tender from the burns. The freezing presence swept its way up my arm, over my chest, and deep into my heart. I felt myself falling, though I stood in place, plummeting through an abyss of thought. The form in front of me was removing its sheet now, and I could see its grey-black skin bristle and distort as though something within it were viciously pounding its way out. Wherever I went through, whatever was waiting for me, I didn't care. My mother had saved me, and I loved her, and soon I would be back to see what she'd done. No torture was too gruesome. No punishment fell short of righteous in my eyes. I only wish that I had still been there to watch it happen. But that was 40 years ago. Now I know that the other side is no kinder than ours, and that there are those who seek out the weakness and vulnerability of others just as readily as they do here. Those faceless beings form a blanket of leering eyes as they wait for their opportunity to strike. 40 years in a nightmare realm, hiding and fighting and struggling to survive against the nameless savagery which mocks our petty struggles here on Earth. 40 years hating myself for leaving this world so readily and fanning that hatred within me to keep me warm against the unending night. I wasn't her daughter. I was her prey. She felt my desperation and came to me knowing I could not refuse her offer. And so she escaped from her world and into mine. It had taken 40 years for her to have her fun and trade places with me again. But even being back, I feel as though I do not belong in this world. Isabel and Viran are likely dead, but I don't even care about that anymore. I'm just waiting for my spectre to show itself again, because I still haven't gotten my revenge. And perhaps in the darkest night of your defeat, he will come for you too, promising to serve you if only you trade places. I pray that even in your loneliest despair, you will maintain the resolve to refuse him. Although, if you don't, then I pray instead I will find you first, so that together we may strive to make this world better instead of fleeing into the grasp of what waits on the other side.
Night 15. Mars Colonization Project. My name is Robert Feldman, and I've been preparing for this mission my entire life. Don't get too excited, though, because the shuttle taking me to Mars is still 15 years away from launching. If the training is any indication of what to expect, then it's going to be the most terrifying experience I could imagine. So why has training already begun? It's simple math, really. The manned mission to Mars has a conservative expenses estimate of $100 billion. If anything goes wrong, then the chances of financing another journey in lieu of the more practical exploration and colonization of nearby asteroids, is slim to none. That means the crew has to be absolutely perfect, and the cost of extensively training us for over a decade is still insignificant compared to the potential disaster from our slightest mistake. There will be numerous expeditions before NASA decides we're ready, including a 2020 rover launch, a year-long training session in the space station around 2024, and then a prolonged orbit around Mars in the early 2030s. After that, the colony will be established, although there is no way for our current level of technology to allow a return journey. We will be terminally isolated, depending entirely on our self-sustaining efforts to survive. Earth's conditions will always be as volatile as the arbitrary leaders controlling launch codes, and I firmly believe the long-term survival of our species is dependent on our ability to spread across the stars. That's why I've devoted my life to this cause. From my master's degree in engineering to my thousands of hours of flight experience in the Air Force, I've honed every aspect of my mind, body, and spirit to help transcend humanity into the heavens. So you can imagine how excited I was to finally receive the phone call from Nigel Rathmore, administrator at NASA. I'd barely been winded from my 8-mile run that morning, but just hearing his voice on the line was enough to make my knees weak. I kissed my wife, and we both laughed and cried, knowing the implications this decision would have for us. I love her with all my heart, but she understands that it's exactly the reason why I must go. It was time for the official training to begin, and I was ready. The training on Earth is divided into three segments: technical training, the mechanical skills required; personal training, psychological profiling and mental preparation for the unnatural ordeal; and simulation training, which will expose us to the conditions we're expected to face. This isn't the story of how I learned to build circuit boards. The technical training is hardly worth mentioning, and neither the other astronauts nor I encountered much we hadn't already prepared for. Besides myself, there was Isaac, the gentle Norwegian giant; Linda, might be cute if she learned to extract the truss rod from her ass; and Jean-Claude, French guy with a superiority complex. I would have enjoyed this part a lot more if I hadn't known that the colonization shuttle was only being designed to house two astronauts. That means they not only expected two of us to fail, they demanded it. These people who I spent my every waking day with weren't friends. They were competition. On the second day, we began our first personal training segments, and I was already hoping that Isaac be the one to graduate with me. The thought of spending the rest of my life trapped on an alien planet with Linda barking orders or Jean-Claude condescendingly redoing my work was absolutely loathsome. We all underwent thorough psychiatric screenings that day. They told us that by the end of the training, we had to look forward to up to a year of solitary confinement to monitor our stability. During that time, we wouldn't be allowed to even speak to another human on the phone, as it was simulating the event of a communications breakdown. As the days went on, the tests became continually more grueling. I could tell the NASA administrators had actively designed this course to cause as much physical and mental discomfort as they could. We were a piece of equipment as sure as any support beam or fuel cell, and if we were going to break, then it would be better for it to happen now, while we could still be replaced. Physical endurance was pushed to its limit as we jogged behind jeeps across searing sand dunes. Our bodies underwent the pummeling of artificial dust storms and wind tunnels, all while undergoing blindfold obstacle courses meant to simulate the storms which ravage Mars and block out over 99% of the sun. Some nights we would be locked in a freezing chamber, which approached the minus 70 centigrade nights on Mars, and our vitals were measured as layer by layer of protective clothing was stripped away until they could record the exact moment we lost consciousness. Jean-Claude was the first one to contract pneumonia from the bitter cold. That didn't stop them from forcing him back into the chamber the next night. He tried to get out of it, but they told him he would be cut from the entire program if he skipped a single segment. That night, Isaac offered one of his outer layers to him, but Jean-Claude was too proud to accept. They had to carry him out on a stretcher, and I didn't see him again after that.
That wasn't the only case of sickness either. I don't think it was part of the original plan. But after that, all of us fell sick at the exact same time. Coughing, fevers, and sores on our skin. I think they must have given us something to study our immune system. It was bad enough to make me delirious, because I kept seeing flashing lights and hearing an odd buzzing sound. I must have blacked out for a bit, because I got flashes of being taken out and brought into a whitewashed room. I was put on a metal table, and the faces staring at me were distorted and twisted into surreal mockeries of what a human face should be. I was afraid, but I didn't let it show. I didn't want to give them any reason to cut me out like they did Jean-Claude. As bad as the physical ordeals were, they were nothing compared to the psychological ones. They'd warned us that they wanted to test our reactions to a variety of situations, but they hadn't told us exactly what to expect. When they told me my wife had been killed in a car crash and showed me photographs of her mutilated body, I was devastated. They talked me through her death, going into explicit detail about how much she suffered from the shards of glass filling her face like shrapnel as she bled out on the highway. It was a full day before they confessed she was fine and that I had passed the test by holding it together. Maybe I was holding it together on the outside, but on the inside, I was pulling further away from everyone. I originally set out on this course for the good of humanity, but it was hard to want to fight for them when everyone I met on a daily basis was there to torture me. I started eating less, smiling less, talking less. The only other person I really opened up to was Isaac. Linda had only grown more caustic as she was pushed towards her breaking point, but Isaac remained a constant source of warm camaraderie and encouragement. His kindness reminded me that there was still good in humanity, and that it was still worth fighting for. And did I ever need that reminder? As we progressed further into the simulated training, we were exposed to a wide range of situations, including maintaining daily routines while they starved us, ingesting radioactive material, and undergoing small amounts of auto-cannibalization, eating slices of our own skin. Some of the simulations were just a virtual reality world, while others were so real that they wouldn't unlock the door until we'd passed out from exhaustion or pain. The line between reality and fabrication grew thinner every day, until it got to the point where I was barely able to distinguish what was training and what was not. That's what I need you to understand before I tell you what happened next. There'd been so many tricks played on us, so many simulations and improbable scenarios, and we weren't allowed to question any of them. When they asked us if we were ready for the next test, "Yes, sir," was the only answer we were allowed to give. To their credit, the training was making us fearless. That's why, when the three of us were locked in a steel room together, we didn't even ask what they were going to make us do. We already knew that we could do it. "This is a simulation game," Nigel's voice came through an intercom on the wall. We all stood immediately to attention. He didn't usually come down to the training facilities himself. The last time he was here, it was because Jean-Claude was being carried out.
"Yes, sir,"
we all barked with military precision.
"There is an alien who has infiltrated the shuttle," Nigel's voice said. "He has taken over one of your bodies and is a direct threat to the remaining crew. Do you understand?"
"Sir, yes, sir."
"I want you to find out who it is, and I want you to kill them."
The intercom crackled and fell silent. We all remained perfectly stiff at attention. Slowly, laboriously, we turned to face each other. Isaac was the only one to grin.
"It's just a simulation," Isaac reminded us. "We don't really have to..."
"That's just what the alien would say," Linda interrupted. "If he infiltrated the shuttle, then he's trying to avoid detection. Of course he would be the one to deny his own existence."
"Listen to yourself, Linda," I said. "We're obviously not going to kill Isaac. The game is just to figure out which of us the others don't think belongs. They're probably going to use this data in their final decision for who the crew will be."
Linda's eyes were wild, though. The pressure of these tests had pushed us all to the edge. But this was the first time in my life I'd ever seen someone start to break before my eyes. She took a step back from us, arms raised as though to fight.
"That's the trick, then,"
she replied. You're both the aliens. He was testing me to see if I realized it.
Listen to Robert, Isaac said. We're all in this together, okay?
If anyone doesn't belong, it's you, Linda, I said. You've always been the difficult one. I'm voting she's the alien.
It's Isaac,
she pointed a shaking finger at him. Her eyes were bulging so badly, I don't know how they stayed in her skull.
Look at his skin. It's so pale.
Linda, get a hold of yourself. I took a step forward, but she leapt back as though under attack.
Get away from me, both of you,
she screamed.
Sorry, Linda, but I have to agree with Robert, Isaac said. I'm voting you out too.
That should have been the end of it. The simulation should have ended. The door should have opened. There's no way they could see Linda's display and still entertain the possibility that she was a good candidate. But the door didn't open. We knocked, we shouted, I even tried climbing on Isaac's shoulders to open the ceiling panels. Nothing. Not for over an hour, when the intercom came to life again.
The alien is still in the room. Kill it.
This was a test. This had to be a test. My next theory was that they wanted to see how loyal we were to our crewmates. Isaac agreed with me, and Linda couldn't hope to take both of us on by herself. She sat on her side of the room, muttering to herself, while Isaac and I sat on the other. We were used to deprivation and isolation. We knew how to wait. Whatever stunt Nigel was going to pull on us now wasn't going to faze us. At least, it wouldn't faze me or Isaac. 1 hour. Then 2. Isaac and I chatted amiably to pass the time, but Linda refused to even acknowledge us. Then, the lights dimmed in artificial nightfall, and we settled further in to wait. Linda was getting more anxious as time passed. She kept standing to pace every few minutes, her hands endlessly twisted over one another, so much that the skin was beginning to wear thin. How much of this would NASA have to see before they knew she wasn't fit for the mission? I shouldn't have fallen asleep. It was just so boring in that room, and I was so tired from the previous day of obstacle courses. I didn't know how long we'd been in here, and we didn't have many chances to rest, so this seemed like a perfect opportunity. Besides, we were being closely monitored, and Isaac was here with me. It should have been perfectly safe. But this was the test I failed. Maybe not in the eyes of NASA, but I failed a much older, much more important test, which was woven into the basic biology of my humanity. In the moment my fellow man needed me most, I wasn't there for him. By the time I woke up, it was too late. Linda had crept over to us through the darkness and wrapped her shoelaces around Isaac's neck. He must have thrashed and struggled, but he wouldn't have been able to scream through his collapsing trachea. By the time I woke, the door was already opening. There were only two of us left alive. The training is still going on. Our mission is too important to be jeopardized by my personal feelings. The fact is that I am the best man available for the job, offering the highest long-term chances of survival for the human race. And Linda? Well, I guess she was the best woman for the job, too. She'd followed orders where I could not, did something which I could not. If anyone is going to make the hard choice to keep the mission going, then I trust her to do it. After all, even in the face of such an impossible situation, she still made the right choice. The moment Isaac's body stopped struggling, I saw the creature fleeing from its dying host. At first, I thought it was a multitude of worms seeping out through his nose and ears, but as they pulled themselves out, it became apparent they were all connected at the base. The whole front of Isaac's face had to split open to allow its body out, but I hope you'll forgive me for not wanting to dwell on the specifics. If it was a simulation, then he must have still killed Isaac to do it. If it wasn't... Well, all that matters is that NASA understands the true obstacles which might jeopardize the safety of our species, and they are taking every precaution to ensure I will be ready. I just wish I could still trust them like I used to, growing up with a naive dream of becoming a spaceman. As I prepare for the next day of training, I can't help but dwell on the conversation I had with Isaac as we passed the last hours of his life. So much work to get you to such a desolate, empty planet, I said. Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Not really, he'd replied. It's not about where you're trying to get to. It's about what you're trying to escape from.
Night 16. An angry midget dresses as little girls to catch paedophiles. Read the title? Good. Then you're up to speed with what's going on. Laptop, 15% batteries. Better keep this moving. I'm hiding behind a tree with Mark Burnham as I'm writing this, although lately he's become more commonly known as Stacy. Pretty soon, a 42-year-old man with a wife he cares nothing about is going to drive up the dirt trail. The man has been getting to know Stacy for the last few days at a nearby park. She seemed to like him, but the man was shy about meeting Stacy's parents. That's why he said he wanted to play out here in the woods, where they wouldn't be around. A white van? Seriously? There he is. Right on schedule. Can't get the bus to arrive on time, but set a date with the predator, and you can set your watch by it. This is Mark's third victim, so I'm starting to get a pretty good idea how this works. Mark Burnham is a 26-year-old midget. I think they prefer to be called little people. He suffers from a hormone disorder which causes proportionate dwarfism, rendering him 4 feet tall but otherwise remarkably normal. Turns out a clean shave and a baggy sweater are enough for him to pass off as a little, albeit chubby, 8-year-old girl named Stacy. I'm watching the 42-year-old climb out of the van. He's looking up and down the trail like he's afraid someone is watching. Bastard doesn't have a clue what's coming. Anyway, I met Mark a couple of weeks ago in our group therapy. I'm not going into the details, but it's enough to know that we both survived a traumatic experience as kids. We got to talking. You can't avoid the awkward small talk after someone just confessed to being turned into a hand puppet. And Mark tried to lighten the mood by making a joke about being the only one who never gets too old for paedophiles. It wasn't a good joke, but our intentions were. The 42-year-old man is calling for Stacy. Mark straightens his wig, and we exchange maniacal grins. It's hard not to laugh while Mark calls out in that shrill, childish voice. The man has spotted Mark now. He's coming this way. Mark scampers farther up the hill, calling for him again. We have to lure them a bit farther into the woods, so no random hikers will interrupt his execution. The man has passed me now. I'm going to follow in a minute. I've got a handgun with me for backup, just in case. I'm not very good with it, but fortunately, I didn't have to use it for the first two times. Mark is a wizard with his butterfly knife and can make a man scream like you wouldn't believe. Deep breath, and go. I followed the man for about 5 minutes before Mark stopped. His little legs were kicking the log he sat on, a mask of pure joy and innocence. The man sat nearby. They were speaking softly. I couldn't catch what they were saying. But it wasn't long before he leaned in to kiss Mark. The wig came off. The knife went in. I don't know which happened first, but I'm sure that both contributed to the dumbfounded shock on the man's face. I jumped out from behind the tree and leveled my gun. Shit. Left the safety on. Doesn't matter, though. Mark had already slashed the man's face and hands a dozen more times. This one was too surprised to even scream. He just stared. Stared as Mark punched him between the eyes. Stared as the blade drove into his stomach. Stared as his throat was cut. Stared and then smiled. Mark was already making some space between them. He was just standing there, shaking in exhilaration. Unsure what to do next. The man rose to his feet and began dusting himself off as though mildly annoyed at discovering dog hair on his jacket. The blood had already stopped flowing. The cuts were healing, tattered flesh plastering themselves together into scabs, which receded into the skin before disappearing entirely. "You're a liar, Stacy," the man said, his voice a dreadful calm.
"Shoot him!" Mark yelled.
I didn't move.
You said you were 8.
The man didn't look at me. He just took another step towards Mark.
They can't be older than 8.
Holy shit, what are you waiting for?
I squeezed the trigger, flinching as the sound ripped the air in half. The dull thud as the bullet hit a tree. The man didn't so much as glance my way. His hand lashed out and grabbed Mark by the neck. I fired again, but I was too afraid of hitting Mark, and it wasn't even close. The man heaved Mark into the air, swinging him wildly in my direction as a shield. The little man's arms were beating helplessly against the implacable grip. Thrashing legs turned the air into a turmoil of desperate energy.
Shoot him! Shoot me! I don't care! Just do something!
I did do something. I watched. And even that was more than I could bear. The man's chest exploded outward, ribs opening wide like so many giant white teeth. His head was bent backwards so sharply that his spine bulged against his neck. His whole body was bending to make way for the impossible jaws. Mark managed to get a few more swipes in, but the abomination pressed the dwarf's entire body into his gaping chest cavity. The ribs snapped shut faster than a striking snake. The horrendous gash that marked where the skin had separated was already fading. Soon, there wouldn't be anything but his torn shirt to show where he had mocked his humanity.
"Bring a real 8-year-old tomorrow," he told me.
I turned and ran, so fast and so hard that every bone in my body felt like it would shatter from the impact of my flying strides.
"Or don't," he shouted after me. "What's the worst that could happen to you?"
Night 17. A painting by day, a window by night. A big black dog rearing on its hind legs to stand like a human. One paw conspiratorially placed in front of its lips, as though swearing the viewer to uphold a shared secret. I hadn't given the painting a second thought, except maybe to remind myself not to bump into it while stumbling down the hall at night to use the bathroom. The painting had never been there growing up, but there had been a lot of changes around my parents' house since I left for college. I had to throw a sleeping bag on the floor of my old room to visit now that they converted the space to a home gym. All the fantasy novels I used to read were in boxes in the garage, and any games I hadn't brought with me were tossed. It was understandable, I guess. I've moved on with my life, and it would be selfish not to expect them to do the same. It just felt weird, sleeping in that room with the ghosts of my former life, replaced by the looming silhouettes of exercise machines. This is where I'd become who I am, filling journals with rambling thoughts, lying awake, dreaming of my first crush, studying and stressing and fighting with private demons that my life once revolved around. That's probably why I couldn't sleep. I feel like I'm too young to have that many memories, but here, they all came rushing back. I lay awake, wondering if that kid was still alive inside me somewhere, or whether he was already dead and replaced with a new person. A stranger that I hadn't even properly met. I used to imagine becoming someone that no one could ever forget. But I'm already in college, and still a nobody. Was I the person that I dreamed about back then? Or had I betrayed myself somewhere along the way? After tossing and turning on the floor for a few hours, I got up to use the bathroom. I had to stop and stare as I passed by the painting of the dog. Savage strokes of thick paint made the fur look like it was bristling. Bared teeth flashed in the moonlight behind its paw, and the playful personification of its stance now seemed like a sardonic mockery of human achievement. The longer I stared, the surer I was. This wasn't the same painting I'd seen in the day. I passed it again the next morning on my way to breakfast, but I couldn't comprehend what I'd found so unsettling during the night. The fur wasn't bristling. It was just fluffy. And those teeth? I could still see them, but it was obviously a smile. I asked my parents about it, but they both just gave each other these confused little shrugs. Somehow, they both figured out the other one had bought it. They'd been doing a lot of home improvement projects, and I guess neither of them had mentioned it to the other. Eventually, they decided that they couldn't even remember a time when it wasn't there. They told me it had been hanging since I was growing up, and that I must have been the one to forget.
The part of me that was worried about everything changing actually found that to be a relief. If I was already starting to forget, then maybe these superficial changes weren't so important. Everything from my childhood that had meant something to me, that had defined me, well, those I would have remembered and taken with me. Everything that had changed, everything I forgot, those were things that it was okay to leave behind. But some things are impossible to leave, no matter how hard you try. I fell asleep easily enough that night, although I woke with a start to a scratching sound. A dark shape was standing over me. I strained against the confines of the sleeping bag, ripping it aside to leap to my feet. No, just the handles of the treadmill. I tried to settle back down, but there was that scratching again. It sounded like it was coming from inside the walls. Mice? Then a long, slow, tearing sound, like a knife running through thick cloth. Not mice. Definitely not mice. I turned on the light and walked along the length of the wall. It was uncomfortable to imagine something running around inside, but the scratching seemed too far away for that. A heavy thump. This wasn't from inside the wall. This was from the other side. Footsteps. I opened the door, flipping on the light in the hallway. A black flash of movement around the corner, just at the edge of my vision. I rubbed my eyes. The painting was face down on the carpet. That must have been the sound I heard. The nail losing its grip on the wall probably made the scratching, and then the thump as it hit the floor. I convinced myself that the flash of movement was nothing more significant than the shadow of the treadmill, until I set the painting upright against the wall. There was a long slash down the center of the canvas, but I couldn't have cared less about the defacement of the art. The fact that the dog was missing from the painting, that's what gripped me. I scrutinized the canvas, even looking under the folded flaps the rip had produced. Nothing. Just heavy brushstrokes of thick blue paint. Scratching. Scratching. A crash. From the other side of the house where my parents slept. I started running towards the noise, but the next sound had me frozen. A wolf's howl, close, somewhere inside the house. Then, shouting for my parents, and I was running again. Tearing, growling, another howl. I flung open their door. Blood was everywhere. On the walls, the floor, even the ceiling fan was dripping. Neither of them had been able to get out of bed before their throats were torn out. One brutal bite each, by the looks of it, as quick and painless as could be expected from whatever. Another howl. Sounded like it was coming from outside, through the broken window. Howling, but more distant now, seemingly moving away. It must have known I was there. My room was closer to it than anything. If this is what it came here to do, then why didn't it touch me? I ran to the window where I saw a dark shape looking back at the house. Nothing more than a shadow, really, standing on its hind legs like a human. It was looking right at me, almost like it was waiting for me to see it. Then it was gone, falling onto all fours to bound into the trees behind the house. I don't know what gave me the courage to follow it that night. It didn't seem like who I was up to this point, but I guess it's up to us to decide who we are from here. My dad had a handgun that he kept in his desk, and he taught me how to use it. I didn't know where I was going, or whether I could even find it. I just knew that I wanted to kill something. As long as I kept thinking about the kill, I wouldn't have to think about the dead. Staying here and facing their bodies, or even just the inescapable thoughts in my head, that's what I wasn't brave enough to do. Either it didn't expect me to follow, or didn't care if I did. The creature made no attempt to cover its tracks. At points, the way seemed deliberately marked with streaks of blood, trampled underbrush, and even the occasional gash torn straight into a tree. I wasn't too far into the woods when the tracks abruptly stopped, though. The deep footprints vanished like it had taken flight. The wilderness was pristine. I turned in slow circles, encompassed with the impossibility of the peaceful night. And with the stillness
came the desperate, unbidden thoughts. The confusion, the disbelief, the helpless rage, blood pounding